This is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Years after what was dubbed the Arab Spring, Egypt is preparing for its first election since a military coup last summer. The candidate presumed to win is General el-Sisi, who led the coup against Islamist President Morsi last July. Since then, he's been the de facto leader of Egypt and has engineered mass crackdowns on dissent. It's not the type of reform many imagined when the fabled Tahrir Square uprisings began, and now some Egyptians are wondering if their revolution has left them any better off than before. Meanwhile, other countries that seemed poised to buck authoritarian rule have also faced setbacks. Syria's civil war only seems to get worse, and in Yemen, reports are of rising danger amid widespread objections to U.S. drone strikes and increased al-Qaeda activity. In fact, looking across North Africa and the Middle East, analysts only find one success story, Tunisia, where it all began. Today in The Exchange, what happened to the Arab Spring? Let's hear from you. What do you think went wrong with these movements? Could the West have approached this differently? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have two guests for the hour. Joining us from Durham, Jeannie Sowers, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH, co-editor of The Journey to Tahrir, Revolution, Protest, and Social Change in Egypt. And Jeannie, welcome back. Great to have you.
Thank you. It's a joy to be here.
Also with us from D.C., Shadi Hamid, fellow at the Brookings Institution, Saban Center for Middle East Policy, and author of Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in the Middle East. Shadi Hamid, good to have you too. Thank you for your time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, both of you, I'll start with you first, Shadi. There was so much hope in the United States for the Arab world when these uprisings got started about three and a half years ago. What were expectations back then, from an American perspective, Shadi, if you could, about how this was going to go?
Sure. Well, I was actually in Tahrir Square the day that Mubarak fell. So, you know, I saw the crowd there erupting in euphoria. It was an amazing moment. And I think you saw a lot of that optimism in the U.S. as well, as Americans were watching these images. And there was a sense that, oh, the Middle East has been a problem for a long time, but maybe we're going to start to see real democratization and political reform and people having more rights in a more general sense. So I think there was an initial surge of optimism, but I think as Americans watched the trajectory of the Arab Spring, they became disillusioned. Of course, I think this is a problem with any revolutionary process. It unleashes very high expectations for the people in those countries and also for outside observers. But we have to be aware of the historical record here. Democracy is messy, uneven. Transitions are difficult. And I think that we got our hopes up a little bit too much. And now Americans are pulling back and saying, well, look, there seem to be a lot of people in the region who are really just killing each other, whether it's over ideology or religion. And I think there's a general Middle East fatigue in the U.S. now, where there isn't a lot of willingness to play a role, and the hope has really diminished. So I think we've seen it come full circle. And I think the bookend for the Arab Spring was the coup in Egypt. I mean, we're talking about the most populous Arab country. And, you know, along with Tunisia, one of the first uprisings in the region. And we not only see a military coup against a democratically elected government, we see a devastating crackdown on the opposition and unprecedented repression. So that's what we're seeing in Egypt. And I think that captures the basic thrust of the Arab Spring more generally.
You know, what do you think, Jeannie, going back three and a half years, what do you remember about some of the hopes that people in this country had?
Well, I think that Shadi is absolutely right. I think that there has been a sort of disengagement, but I think it's entirely premature. And I think his point about the historical record is absolutely right. So in this country and in every other country that sort of struggles on the road to democratization, which is a long-term process. It's not a simple end goal, and it looks different in different places. So the Middle East and North Africa has undergone a sort of fundamental transformation, and we shouldn't take the reconsolidation of sort of, you know, a military regime in Egypt or, you know, places where we had more hopes for a more rapid transition. I think those hopes were simply historically inaccurate. And just as the West actually went through many, many decades and in many cases took 100, 150 years, it's not fair to sort of foreclose the possibilities of the Arab uprisings, you know, by saying, well, it's 3.5 years and we haven't gotten to where we wanted to. And that's actually, I think, a fault of actually the public in Egypt as well, who very quickly said, well, our expectations aren't met. We're not doing anything correctly. We have to get rid of Morsi, you know, and this whole sort of trajectory. So we really have to scale back our expectations, but that doesn't mean that actually there's not fundamental transformation underway, which there is.
You know, following up on what you said, Jeannie, you said democracy looks different in different places. And I also appreciate both of you making the point about it takes time. I mean, when you look at our own history and the history of Europe, there were hundreds of years of war before people kind of figured it out. I wonder, Jeannie, if though back 3 years ago, if many Americans thought that the transition in the Arab world might be like what we saw a couple decades before in Latin America, where you had, you know, a tradition of sort of strong men leaders, and they transitioned to democracy relatively quickly.
Well, I could ask my colleague, who's a Latin Americanist, here for her analogy, but I would just say that I think even in Latin America, right, it was very uneven. Actually, different countries went at different paces, and also you have a reconsolidation of kind of trends towards authoritarianism in some places. So I think that it's actually not so dissimilar from Latin America as we might think. Again, it's just a question of your time horizon.
Yeah.
I think the other analogy that people thought of was Eastern Europe. And I think there is a huge similarity to actually what's taking place in the Arab world, which is that just as in Eastern Europe, sort of the withdrawal of Soviet power and the kind of collapse of the model of sort of state-centered socialism and these kind of variants of communism kind of took hold, that actually has taken hold in the Middle East and North Africa. And there's a huge amount of dissent within those countries about what the future shape of these regimes should be and who should be included and how. And those kind of debates are very, very intense and very fundamental. But the fact that those debates are happening is what's new and what is actually incredibly promising, because as soon as regimes don't allow those debates, you can't actually start to resolve these fundamental questions of citizenship and participation and rights and rules. So the fact that there are these incredibly intense discussions as well as sort of conflicts, I think is to be expected, and it's not sort of the end. It's actually the beginning.
You know, I want to pick up, Shadi, on Jeannie's point about democracy looks different in different places. How much do you think American policymakers or your average American appreciates that? Their democracy might not look like our democracy.
Yeah. Well, let me just say first on this issue of Latin American other comparisons that I do think there is something distinctive about the Arab world. The nature of ideological and religious divides are somewhat different. In Latin America, it was primarily about economics, and that's tangible. You can actually have a reasoned discussion about that. But I think what we're seeing in the Middle East is a raw existential battle between people of different worldviews and different ideologies, and they haven't been able to resolve the fundamental questions of what makes a state or society. You know, what's the role of religion in public life? What's the meaning of the nation state? What's the identity of Egypt or Tunisia? And this gets to your question that, you know, if the Middle East is distinctive in this regard, what does that mean for the evolution of democracy? And one of the arguments, you know, I make in my new book is that if for democracy to flourish in the Middle East, it's probably going to have to look a little bit different. It's not necessarily going to be liberal. It's not going to fully respect the same rights perhaps that we're used to in the U.S. after 200 plus years of our own democratic transition and so on. When it comes to gender equality, the protection of minority rights, the role of the state in promoting a certain conception of religion, we're talking about deeply conservative societies, and any democratically elected government is going to have to reflect that to some extent. So it's not as if we're going to see this bold move towards liberalism or secularism as we had in our own countries in the West, but we may actually see some of these religious sentiments and whether it's, you know, hyper-nationalism or xenophobia, ideology might actually come to the fore. And I think it's part of what we're seeing in countries like Egypt, where people are essentially killing each other over a variety of reasons. But I think at front and center is this issue of the role of religion and the identity of the state.
Yeah, it's different from Eastern Europe then, perhaps. They don't seem to have had that fundamental debate over what the role of religion is. Maybe Latin America too, Hamid, most people are Catholic. Yeah, go ahead, Jeannie.
If you look at the Yugoslav wars, you can make the same argument.
Well, no, that's
right?
A good point. Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's very easy to be complacent about what America supposedly has achieved. And even there, I would say that the issues of religion and public life are very much at the forefront of the way our political parties frame themselves, the kind of social issues that people mobilize around. So I think it's very easy to gloss over the kind of tumultuous history of the West as and say, therefore, that is the end point. That being said, I agree with Shadi that there are these fundamental worldviews and different perspectives colliding, but I think those are also rooted, actually, in sort of economic transformations that are underway in the region. So if we look at who led some of the protests in places like Tahrir, there was this kind of catalytic role for sort of urban, relatively well-educated youth. And then as that process comes on and it draws in all these other groups with lots and lots of differing perspectives, you do start to have these very fundamental conflicts. But the point is those societies are changing actually quite quickly, and they're changing as a result partly of economic change, which actually mirrors the growth of the middle class in the West. It mirrors kind of the growth of labor activism, labor politics in the West. So I think it's a little bit misleading to sort of, again, fall into the, you know, Middle East, North Africa is distinctive. It is distinctive. Of course, all regions are distinctive, but the way we analyze them actually is through using the same sets of themes and concepts.
All right. A point well taken, Jeannie. And our phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in The Exchange, we're taking a look at the series of uprisings many dubbed the Arab Spring about 3 years ago. We're finding out what happened, especially given the bad news coming out of several of these countries, among them Egypt, Yemen, and of course Syria. Let's hear from you after a short break. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. More conversation in just a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR reaches listeners all over New Hampshire. If you own or operate a business, you can get your message to the entire state by simply becoming an NHPR underwriter. Visit the support page at nhpr.org to find out more about our many underwriting opportunities. More on what happened to the Arab Spring on the Exchange, then at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, regulating domestic drones to protect privacy and public safety. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the New Hampshire Division of Economic Development, helping Granite State businesses grow and prosper online at nheconomy.com. From Dr. Brian Herdifer of Manchester, creating and designing custom-fitted sports guards for athletes, including the Boston Bruins, details at bruinsdentists.com. A New Hampshire Home Magazine featuring restored and remodeled older homes for today's lifestyles. New Hampshire Home Magazine, design and decor for the home and garden. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what happened to the Arab Spring? Let's hear from you. What do you think went wrong with these movements? Could the West have approached this differently? What are your hopes for this region in the future? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Shadi Hamid, fellow at the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy, and Jeannie Sowers, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH. And before we go to our listeners, both of you, Shadi, I want to start with you. How do you answer the question of why America should care about all this? Why don't we just let them figure it out?
Well, I mean, I think one of the lessons of the past, 10, 15 years in terms of our relationship with the Middle East is that what happens in the Middle East doesn't stay there. It can come back to haunt us and affect us. We obviously saw that with the attacks of September 11th. So we can't pretend that we're isolated somehow. And I think more generally, we live in a globalized economy where, you know, everything depends on everything else. If the economic context of the Middle East continues to deteriorate, and let's say we have issues with, you know, the free flow of oil or energy, that obviously has an impact on America's economy. And, you know, if there's war in Syria, you know, then that has a spillover effect that affects a lot of our allies. And I mean, we could, of course, you could argue that, well, you know, that's too bad. And, you know, we're willing to kind of absorb the cost if certain problems happen. But I think there's also this issue of what the role of the U.S. in the world should be. If we don't step up and play a role and try to support democratic transitions and try to improve our policies in the region, then there's going to be a political and power vacuum. And people that we don't agree with will fill that vacuum. And I think we're seeing that in a very stark way in a country like Syria, which is being destroyed. And I think that in particular is going to haunt us for years, if not decades to come. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's really a question of how Americans see their country. And I would just pose the question, if we don't step up and play the role, then what exactly is the alternative?
You know, and Jeannie, I want to hear from you too on this, but very quickly, Shadi, fold what you just said into what you talked about earlier, this Middle East fatigue that you see with the American public. I mean, I hear the argument that you're making, but then, as you said earlier, Americans are tired of all the conflict in this region.
Well, part of the problem here is that I think we have an administration that hasn't made the case to the American people that this is directly relevant to our national security interests. There has to be some leadership. It's not simply about looking at public opinion and polls and saying, well, people are tired, so we can't be too involved. I think Obama had the opportunity to play a much, much more of a leadership role on foreign policy, particularly on the Middle East. But I think the American people can see that his heart simply hasn't been in it. And even when he was talking about intervention in Syria last summer when military strikes were being discussed, everyone could tell that Obama really, really did not want to do this. So the American people can sense this. And I think there has to be, you know, a much more clear case made and explaining how this affects us at home and it affects our economy.
Yeah. What do you think, Jeannie?
I agree in some ways. I think that the question of fatigue is a question of what happens when the U.S. gets involved and makes the case that, you know, there's an imperative case for national security, which it did in Iraq in 2003. And I think the American public rightly feels that that case was oversold, that the costs have been enormous, that the consequences have actually not been very helpful to U.S. national interests, or certainly to the many people who have had to go. So I think that, quote, fatigue is simply a result of actually past U.S. government decisions that are actually not very, you know, they're very recent. So I agree with this notion that you shouldn't let the shadow of that past then dictate what you do now, especially regarding a place like Syria. And I think it's a question of not do you get involved, but the question is how, right? Because nobody's, I think, rightfully thinking about sort of full-scale military intervention in Syria. So that then leaves us with what are our options, which I think is a much more difficult task. I think that the administration deserves a slight amount of credit for trying to negotiate with Russia over Syria, because I think that was sort of the logical avenue to pursue, which is that if the two sort of powers with great stakes in Syria, plus, you know, China and maybe Hezbollah, could have actually come up with a path forward and Iran, that might have worked. However, that has failed kind of conclusively. So I think we're getting, how do we get involved?
In and what way? What's appropriate? Yeah.
Well, I think the one time that the U.S. did draw a line was over the use of chemical weapons. And this kind of speaks to Shadi's point, right, which is that the one time we sort of were very clear, very resolute, we did get an outcome, which is a negotiated outcome. And actually, it's with a lot of delays and actually some problems. But generally, it's actually successful. And it looks like or appears that, according to the UN, the vast majority of its chemical weapons supplies have been destroyed or moved out of the country, with the exception of chlorine gas. But so I think that's an example of what was successful. The problem here is, I think, that the U.S. does not always support democratic transitions, and because it has competing interests. So one way we could go after the Syria question would be to start basically talking about it as a set of crimes against humanity by the regime. So we have the Civil War dynamic. That's one piece of it. But then we have another piece, which is that we actually have a regime that has basically broken all of the sort of norms and rules set up since World War II. And we can't actually call attention to that or prosecute it because the U.S. has such an ambiguous relationship with both the international conventions and the International Criminal Court and other mechanisms of kind of international accountability. So in a way, we're hamstrung on some of these issues because we don't want them to apply to us. We only want them to apply to others, which means then we can't actually use them in very clear cases of crimes against humanity, such as have been happening in Syria.
Go ahead, Shadi. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think, I totally agree that it's not just about national security. There's a very strong moral case, too, especially when we look at a country like Syria, that when, 150,000 plus people are being killed, and, there's an opportunity, I think, for the international community to take a strong stand against mass killing. And I think that is also an international obligation. And I think if you pose the question that way to Americans and say, well, if we don't get involved, then this killing will continue, I think generally the American people have been supportive of stopping genocide or mass slaughter. I will disagree, though, on this issue of chemical weapons. I think that deal was actually a boon for Assad and probably one of the best things that happened to him. This was never about chemical weapons. But before the chemical weapons attack of last summer, 100,000 people had been killed by conventional weapons. So I think, that's the issue here. It's that there's mass killing, and we shouldn't say to Assad that, you can kill however much you want, but when you kill with chemical weapons, that's where we draw a red line. That sends a very dangerous message that he can get away with pretty much anything. And I think also, making the case around chemical weapons is simply not compelling to the American people. It's a confusing case. It's not clear because a lot of people were asking, well, why didn't we get involved earlier if people had been killed for the past 2 years?
Again, the phone number for you to join our conversation. Looking at the Arab Spring across the Middle East and North Africa, what has happened in the roughly 3 years since this began? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're taking your questions, comments, thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Wall one word, or you can find us on Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And both of you, let's go to our listeners now. And Phil is waiting in Hanover. Hi, Phil. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to say that I think that democracy is very fragile, the living organism that can evolve, devolve, or mutate, and that the United States is not immune to that. We ought not to look too askance at the Middle East. I think that whenever extremism, whether religious or ideological, gets into play and people are willing to sacrifice community and the common good for individualism and individual ideals, the potential for corruption is there. Look at our current situation in terms of our congressional inability to come to common ground. And look at the Bundy Ranch situation, where militants are willing to take up arms to get their way.
Well, Phil, thanks for the call. And it relates to something you said earlier, Jeannie. The other regions, whether it's the United States, whether it's Latin America, whether it's Eastern Europe, democracy has its struggles.
Right. And I think the point about democracy will change and evolve and actually can be less democratic over time is a really important point. Just to go back to Shadi's original point, too, which is actually I agree with you about the chemical weapons. I'm using it as an example of one instance in which the U.S. was very clear and drew boundaries. But I agree with you that the consequences actually of that allowed the Assad regime to actually not only continue with its past practices, but actually escalate them. So the kind of siege and starvation of cities, the use of barrel bombs, all these kind of horrific things actually escalated during the Geneva talks as well. So I think that's exactly right.
So pulling back, both of you, and Jeannie, I'll go to you first since we're going there now. All right. The Arab Spring broadly, again, this region broadly, could America, Jeannie, have done something differently to make these uprisings more successful, less violent? I mean, is there anything we could have really done better?
Well, it, well, again, I'll just say that I think what went wrong is premature. So I think that they are going
sure.
to work their way out. But
we're too impatient when we talk about this.
Yes, and also, more importantly, there is, and Shadi was getting to this, I think, earlier, where he talked about kind of what he sees as the nature of a sort of Arab democracy and democratic debates, which is that these uprisings in many ways have to be worked out internally. There is no magic solution from the outside that the U.S. or any other country could actually do. And that's okay. And in fact, that actually most Egyptians and Tunisians and Libyans and so on and so forth want that up to a certain extent. What they don't like, and this is where I think it's very interesting to look at kind of past U.S. policy in the region, is that Egyptians now think that America calls the shots in all sorts of ways where we don't actually call the shots. In other words, the illusion of our power is so much greater than the actual power that we have in the region. And I think this is a problem both for the Arab publics and it's a problem for our own. Because actually, it's very difficult to get involved in these ways. That being said, there's a couple concrete things that I think most sort of academics or scholars or analysts in the Middle East would agree on, which is that the U.S. relationship with Egypt is obviously one in which now, as in the past, we are supporting the reconsolidation of autocratic rule. And that's and we should be absolutely clear about that. I mean, if we're going to do it, we should just say that's what we're doing. And but the notion that the U.S. really didn't call a halt to kind of military assistance, I understand the domestic reasons why. I never thought it was likely. But still, it's a very clear instance of how the U.S. actually doesn't always support democratic transitions in the Middle East and actually can work quite actively against them.
Well, and that leads to cynicism, doesn't it, Shadi?
Yes, certainly. And I think, you know, our support of the military after the coup, and again, this was a military coup against Egypt's first democratically elected head of state, and by law, we're supposed to suspend military assistance in the event of coups against elected governments. So we weren't even willing to follow our own law. But it's really worth emphasizing that Egypt isn't just a case of a repressive regime. It's one of the most repressive regimes in the region. And the scale of it is really remarkable. I mean, I think a lot of us knew it would be bad when the coup happened, but it's far worse than I could have imagined. I mean, we're talking about more than 16,000 arrested in just 10 months, more than 2,500 killed, the worst, what Human Rights Watch calls the worst case of mass killing in modern Egyptian history, which took place on August 14th, where more than 600 people were killed in the matter of hours. So it's, you know, I think that is, first of all, it's morally abhorrent that we continue to support a military regime that is overseeing that kind of behavior. That's one. But I would also say more generally that we've also committed a relatively small amount of funding to the Arab transitions. If we look from 2011 to 2013, we've only committed about $2 billion of new assistance. If you compare that to the Marshall Plan after World War II, not to say it's at the same scale or the same importance, but just for comparison's sake, we committed more than $100 billion in today's dollars to the rebuilding of Western Europe over the course of several years. So just kind of think about that gap for a second, which shows that there wasn't really any real political will to get really serious about this and make a commitment to the Arab people and say, well, yes, we have been supporting autocratic regimes for decades. And I think we have to be very honest about our tragic history of supporting repressive regimes and undermining democracy in the region. But the Arab Spring was our chance to get it right the second time around. But now we're back to business as usual, where it's as if the Arab Spring never happened. If you see Secretary of State John Kerry and what he says in the region, if you were an alien from outer space watching, you'd say, wait, there was an Arab Spring? We're not acting that way at all.
Well, and to this point, and this is the broader question that I was asking, so I'm glad you raised the money, Shadi. So, all right, maybe more money would have helped, but what do you fund and what don't you fund? That's always a problem, you know, because you don't want to give it to, I don't know, terrorist groups. You don't want to give it to dictators. It's always very tricky. We hear about Afghanistan, all the redevelopment money that's gone there, and a lot of it's just been, you know, who knows where it ends up going. So how do you get around that? I mean, I appreciate the comparison between Arab Spring and Marshall Plan, but where do you put the money?
Well, one is that we can reduce assistance to countries that don't meet minimal standards on democracy that are repressive. So, for example, Egypt's a very clear case of that. $1.3 billion a year of military aid, you know, we should be suspending that. Now, on the other hand, I think incentivizing reform is very important. So a more kind of positive conditionality where if countries meet various benchmarks when it comes to free and fair elections, respect of opposition rights, expanding freedoms of speech and freedom of the press, that they can be eligible for additional funding. And there's different ways to structure that kind of incentivized aid. It's not easy, but these are things that we've thought about a long time. Democracy practitioners have written about this for quite some time. But I think what you have to have is sticks and carrots. And the carrots are very important to say to countries that are at least moving in the right direction, such as Tunisia, that you're doing a good job, you're moving in the right direction. And for that reason, we're going to commit a significant amount of new assistance. But even on that front, where Tunisia is one of the very few bright spots, we've been very slow to offer more commitments there.
What do you think, Jeannie?
I agree in general. And I would say that I think also, rather than just thinking about it as foreign assistance, which because most of it does actually go back to U.S. contractors, has actually a really spotty record in terms of either promoting development or democracy, I think that you actually should rethink things like global trade regimes and basically forms of foreign investment. So it's for a country like Tunisia, the really important partners would be the EU. So to the extent that the United States can work with the EU to basically encourage foreign investment, also to encourage actually basically labor market restrictions, right? I mean, people have to be able to go where work is. So that's when we immediately touch upon the problems that democratization isn't just an internal process, but actually can be hindered by all sorts of restrictions, whether it's on the movement of people or the movement of goods. So food is a really interesting example. So in a country like Egypt, there's a large number of people still working in agriculture, even though it's not a large percentage of GDP. And yet it's very hard to actually make a living in agriculture because of the international system of subsidizing grain production in the U.S. and in Europe. So again, when we start to think a little more creatively, there is a lot of ways to do what Shadi was saying, incentivize sort of transitions. But I think they really then start touching very quickly on domestic politics outside the country.
All right. In a moment, I want to ask both of you about a thoughtful piece I came across recently, 8 Hopeful Legacies of the Arab Spring. Interesting to read since there seems to be a lot of bad news from this area. But this writer said that there was reason for hope in the region. I'll ask you about that after a short break. And we'll take more of your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. All one word. More conversation about the Arab Spring in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, regulating domestic drones to protect privacy and public safety. Then, how scientists have relied on injuries and freak accidents to learn about the human brain. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather partly to mostly cloudy today and cooler with high temperatures, upper 50s to lower 60s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from New England College with a convenient site in downtown Concord, offering master programs in public policy, business, and mental health counseling. Registration at nec.edu. And Dr. Nanda of Nashua offering minimally intrusive alternatives for those with sleep apnea and who are CPAP intolerant. More information is available at centerfordentalsleepmedicine.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, have youth sports become too competitive? Join us for that conversation tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, we're revisiting the Arab Spring, 3 years into the uprisings that many dubbed the Arab Spring. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Find us on Twitter at NHPR Exchange or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Shadi Hamid, fellow at the Brookings Institution, Saban Center for Middle East Policy, and Jeannie Sowers, associate professor of political science at UNH, co-editor of the Journey to Tahrir, revolution, protest, and social change in Egypt. And both of you, I wanted to ask you about something I came across just yesterday in the New Yorker called Eight Hopeful Legacies of the Arab Spring. Now, I won't go through all eight. We've put it up on our website if folks want to take a look. But here's one thing that this writer mentions. He says, thanks to mass protests, the pressure for reform remains strong. Ruling elites can no longer afford to ignore public demands. What do you think, Shadi? Too optimistic or do you agree?
Look, when people ask me, like, is there something to be optimistic about in the region, I have a lot of trouble, and I don't think there's a lot of reason to try to even look at the bright side at this point.
Really? I mean, wow.
Yes. I'm actually very pessimistic on this point because, yes, people are going to protest and there's going to be popular discontent, but repression can be effective. And I think that's one of the lessons of the Arab Spring, that if you have a zero tolerance approach to dissent, if you go and just kill people and mow them down, they can protest all they want. They can talk about Gandhi and Martin Luther King and civil disobedience, but that's not going to be a whole lot. First of all, with an international community that doesn't care a whole lot and no one's really willing to act. And so you have these regimes that can actually get away with quite a lot. And I think when Bashar al-Assad in Syria saw what happened in Egypt and Tunisia, he said to himself, the mistake of these leaders is they gave up too quickly. They didn't kill enough people. So I think what you're seeing, whether it's in Syria and to lesser degrees, but also important to look at these other examples, whether it's Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, we discussed Egypt, what we see is pretty much a zero tolerance approach to dissent. And there's also the issue that popular mobilization can be used to support regimes too. It's not as if it's just on the opposition side. In Egypt right now, you have millions of Egyptians who passionately and enthusiastically support a very repressive regime. And when I was there right before the August 14th massacre, I actually talked to friends and colleagues of mine in Egypt who were openly supporting mass slaughter without shame. So this kind of popular aspect can also be very dangerous because that actually emboldens regimes to crack down even harder.
What do you think, Jeannie? Are you feeling as pessimistic as Shadi is?
On the bad days, absolutely.
Just kind of depends on.
I think he's absolutely right. And in terms of the popular support, I think I also work on Egypt. And like Shadi, it's actually been very difficult the last couple of years, because especially this past year, because I think in the U.S., most of us quite clearly saw what would happen after the military took power. And we considered kind of our friends and cohorts who were kind of cheering on the military to be actually somewhat naive. But that was easy to do because we were not the ones feeling threatened. So, but I would say that I think that it's right. Public demand and public outrage actually can kind of go all different ways. But one thing that I think is interesting is that there are ways to leverage public dissent, and I think that various groups and sectors in these countries have actually started to figure that out. So it's actually important both before the decade before the revolution in Egypt and then afterwards that labor strikes and all sorts of basically labor actions by professionals, by syndicates, by postal workers actually have concrete impacts on the economy. So repression only gets you so far. And even this regime, just like the Mubarak regime, actually will find that it's in these kind of endless negotiations with all sorts of demands from all sorts of groups. And that's, again, it makes certain kinds of market reform even harder. It makes public decision-making very complex. But the notion that first there was never public demands made on the state is simply wrong. And then the notion that somehow, you know, the new mobilization is going to just completely die out, it may or may not. But again, I think it's just too early to tell. But I agree. On the bad days, it is not a nice situation.
Let's take another call if we could. Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join our conversation, looking broadly at the Arab Spring, 1-800-892-6477. And Steve's been waiting in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the exchange.
Yes. I'm a psychiatrist, and I want to take a historical view of this in terms of people and freedom. What I want to oppose is the model of the French Revolution, where the group, the mob, the people took over, and then that followed by a repressive regime, and it goes back and forth. And finally, the pendulum goes from the people to the government to back and forth, where they get a democracy. So I feel that there is a cadence to these revolutions, which we escaped in the American Revolution for a lot of good reasons, but they're not escaping the Arab Spring.
Yeah. You know, Steve, I appreciate the historical analogy. We talked about this earlier, and what do you think about the French Revolution comparison, Shadi? He's right. It took a long time, and it was pretty bloody.
Yeah. So in the short run, I'm pessimistic, but in the long run, yeah, I share that basic premise that over time, there's almost a kind of self-correcting mechanism. People try out different things. There's violence. There's civil conflict. People back down from that and realize they have to live together. So, yes, in the long run, I think we are going to see a move to some kind of democratic governance in at least some of these countries, including in Egypt. But then, you know, I think the difficult and thorny question there is, what if, you know, democracy is not a panacea. And for us as Americans who value democracy, but we also value liberalism, I mean, certain rights that we consider to be non-negotiable, what happens if Arabs, if Egyptians, Tunisians decide through the democratic process that they don't want to be liberal, that they want to further Islamize their societies? And I think we've always had a challenge as Americans in respecting democratic outcomes that we disagree with. And it tends to be the case that when there are free elections in the region, Islamist parties that want more religion in politics, not less, tend to either win or do quite well. So I don't think that we've resolved that fundamental dilemma.
Well, and here's an email to that point from Don in Londonderry. Don says, religion is the core of the matter, as the guest said. But until religion is out of the question, it will always be used by the powerful to keep the masses focused away from the true cause of their economic hardships. Don says, our founders made sure that religion could not be used by the government used as the government crutch or heretics as a straw man. So here we are, you know, the role of religion in politics, and it is different in the Middle East than it is here, perhaps. Jeannie Sowers, go ahead. Your response to Don.
Well, I think to both points. So I think, again, religion isn't static. So I think in an ironic way, if you talk to many young Egyptians, they're actually they consider themselves extremely pious Muslims or Coptic Christians. But most of them actually no longer kind of buy the line about kind of the Islamic State. And ironically, I do think there's merit to the argument that because the kind of bottom-up processes of kind of making people more religious actually happened in the 1990s, largely as a result of actually social movements working through charities and social services because they couldn't organize politically as well, that in a funny way, this notion that just because the Muslim Brotherhood won the first set of parliamentary elections and presidential elections in Egypt, that they would always win, I think is actually a mistake. Because if you look at the actual outcomes of those elections, what you see is that, first of all, there was large numbers of kind of non-Islamist parties, but they were very small, they were completely disorganized, and they actually didn't have time to sort of figure out how to be a party in the time to those elections. So usually you would expect that the kind of solid majorities that, when actually the Muslim Brotherhood took like slightly over a third, Salafi parties, which are even more conservative organizations, took another third of the vote. So two-thirds of the population in Egypt in the parliamentary elections voted for parties that were explicitly organized around religious principles. But the other third of the electorate didn't. And so what you would expect to see over time is kind of a consolidation into fewer parties that then will move toward the center to capture more votes. And really, if we actually want to talk about an optimistic scenario, we should at least talk about Tunisia. So Tunisia adopted a new constitution after an extraordinary amount of sort of dialogue, discussion, and some violence. They looked at what happened in Egypt in July, and El Nahda, which is the Islamist party that had gained a plurality of the votes and had the prime ministerial position, the prime minister actually resigned, and they have a technocratic power-sharing government to try to sort of serve as this interim until they have elections this year. So I think this notion of that there's it's going to be religious, it means it will be religious, but it will change in how and what parties choose to focus on. And Tunisia's been a good example where this very intense conflict between Islamic parties and then a range of other parties has actually, they looked at the abyss next door in Egypt and in Libya and thought, let's just pull back and slow down.
So to Don's point, Jeannie, yeah, you can't take religion out of the equation, as he puts it.
Well, I don't think religion is out of the equation in any political system. So this is where I kind of object to the terms of the debate, actually.
All right. Let's take one more call if we could. Thank you, Don, for that email. And to York, where Jim is on the air. Hi, Jim. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thank you. I was calling to ask the interviewee's opinions about the Obama administration's policies towards Iraq and Syria. The policies are highly divergent, despite the fact that the two countries are facing in what are in some respects similar situations. Both are Shiite-led regimes allied with Iran, fighting Sunni, largely Sunni rebel groups and insurgencies. However, in Syria, the Obama administration is wholeheartedly supporting the Syrian rebels, arming and training them, whereas in Iraq, it is arming the, and supporting the Nouri al-Maliki's regime. So it seems, in essence, given that some of the groups these governments are fighting are across the border of the two countries, including ISIS, for example, has territory in both countries. From an outsider perspective, it seems as though the Obama administration is supporting two sides in a regional war, both warring sides. And I was curious about your input on that.
Okay. Jim, thanks a lot for calling in. Shadi, you want to tackle that one, please?
Yeah, well, first of all, the U.S. is not wholeheartedly supporting the Syrian opposition. If anything, its support has been incredibly weak to the point where the Syrian opposition has been, you know, in some cases accusing the U.S. of, you know, being complicit in mass slaughter, because they've done very little over the course of the last 2 years. So, I mean, the U.S. isn't really fully engaged on any side in particular, and I think this reflects the Obama administration's general approach to the Middle East, which is split the middle. Don't take strong positions. Don't get too involved. Obama sees his legacy as being primarily in the domestic sphere and also in unwinding two very unpopular wars. And that's fine, but I think Obama has let himself become, in a sense, you know, a victim of the Iraq War's legacy, that in trying to disassociate himself from the Bush administration, he's gone all the way to the opposite side. And I think we as a country are still fighting the last war. Why should Syrians pay the price for our mistakes in Iraq? And I think that we've had a lot of trouble separating these conflicts and seeing them as separate and as happening in very different contexts.
You know, one last question for both of you, and it relates to what I said a couple minutes ago about this piece, Eight Hopeful Legacies of the Arab Spring. Here's another one, and Jeannie, I'll throw this to you first because you mentioned younger people in this part of the world. This article said, many of the demographic and technological factors that underpin the Arab Spring are still in place. Young Arabs are increasingly well-educated and have access to technology and information that their parents did not, which makes it more difficult for the elites to manipulate or ignore them. What do you think, Jeannie? Is that a possible reason for hope?
I think it's a relatively thin strata among the sort of general population that they're describing. And I think the sort of general public support for the reconsolidation of kind of a military regime in Egypt sort of, you know, gives us pause. That being said, I think that the youth are... I do think that people have a stronger sense of political engagement than they did in the past. And I think that people may be also, though, when you face a situation that you can't change, you may either despair, you may become apathetic, you may try to work in community development or local organizations. And most of the people I know in Egypt are turning to that avenue. They feel that kind of elite politics has now moved beyond them and is closed off again. So many of them are moving to actually what the Muslim Brotherhood moved to in the 1990s, ironically, which is actually to work for what you can at sort of a local level. So, you know, I don't know where the youth will go.
So all the access to, you know, information and finding out what is happening in other parts of the world or other parts of the region, it doesn't matter, Jeannie, if you're feeling so helpless in your own situation.
Well, I think the economic situation is so dire, sort of across the board, that people really have to focus on actually making a livelihood.
Sure.
And the handful of people, you know, not the handful, but I mean, there's many thousands who actually exit the country and will continue to try to leave these countries to work elsewhere. So I think the sort of economic conditions are going to make it that there is going to be very high public dissent, and that it has both opportunities for kind of organizing, and it also means that governments are actually going to have a continued sort of tumultuous scene. I mean, if you're the Egyptian military, really it's not a job that you would want. There is going to be no way for them to actually sort of develop the country quickly, provide employment, deal with kind of public subsidies, all these kind of structural economic problems are still there. And worse, you've now cut off sort of the political mechanisms by which you could start to have the debates about actually what kind of public policies would people come to support.
Shadi, go ahead. Wrap it up for us, if you could, please, including your thoughts on sort of the youth, and they're the ones that were out on the streets protesting, and where they're at this point.
So, I mean, I think the again, not to be too pessimistic, but the darker side here is that it was actually a youth movement, Tamarud, that started off the movement in support of a military coup. And they were one of the biggest supporters.
Yeah,
in Egypt. And one of the biggest supporters of the military takeover. And they were they were the ones distributing this petition, essentially calling for the downfall of the Brotherhood and all of that. And also, I think if you look at the Islamist opposition on the other side of the spectrum, you see young Brotherhood members, a minority of them, turning to low-level violence. But also, I think a larger number of them that don't see any hope for reconciliation, they're becoming more revolutionary and in that sense more radical, seeing the state as an enemy and the only solution is the destruction of the state. So, yes, technology and all that is good, but again, there's the darker side.
Okay, well, Shadi, thank you very much for being with us. Real interesting stuff. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Shadi Hamid, fellow at the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy, author of Temptation of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in the Middle East. Jeannie Sowers, always a pleasure. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Jeannie Sowers, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH, co-editor of The Journey to Tahrir, Revolution, Protest, and Social Change in Egypt. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, are kids' sports too intense? There's a lot of concern these days that an ethic of winning at all costs is ruining youth athletics, promoted by overzealous parents or coaches, and that kids are paying the price, from sports injuries at ever younger ages to constant practice that cuts into family time. But now some adults are crying foul and are calling for change. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, orthopedics and team physicians for the UNH Wildcats, providing repair for knee and shoulder injuries for UNH athletes, sosmed.org, and the grand family of Stay Motors Lincoln since 1919, and now serving the former Lincoln of Concord market area for all automotive needs. Stay Motors Lincoln, exit 9 south off I-93, North Manchester.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Steve Roberts of the George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. Civilian use of drones is taking off, creating new opportunities for business and media. Small unmanned aircraft are used to film commercials, report on storms, and market real estate. But there's one big problem. Commercial drones are illegal. A recent near miss between a drone and an airplane in